May it please the court and counsel, my name is Jason Wood. I'm attorney for the appellant in this matter. I'm trying to recover from the flu, so I apologize in advance if I have a coughing fit.
That's why I'm down here, counsel, on video, so you have my utmost sympathies.
And you have mine as well. Thank you. Excuse me. As I'm sure the court has thoroughly reviewed the briefs, I will dispense with going through in detail the facts of the case, other than to just give a brief summary. My client, Kevin Mays, was a chronic alcoholic. He was arrested for violation of a civil protection order on November 7th of 2008 and incarcerated in the Nez Perce County Jail in Idaho. Sometime before the 14th of November, Mr. Mays began suffering and experiencing symptoms of acute alcohol withdrawal syndrome, or delirium tremens. His symptoms worsened over time, over the next 2 days, beginning with hallucinations, becoming gradually more incoherent, began harming himself, and on two prior occasions before he suffered the injury that's the subject of this case, he had beaten his head against the door and walls of his cell, resulting in bleeding and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Finally, let me ask you, let me just ask, what do we do with the fact that it's undisputed they took him to the doctor that Sunday afternoon?
I think ultimately that's the crux of probably both the district judge's decision as well as the appellee's. Our position, Your Honor, is that although they did take him to the hospital for emergency room treatment, the record actually indicates the reason they did was not because of necessarily alcohol withdrawal syndrome, delirium tremens, but because he had injured his hand. I suppose that's a little indirect. But
the doctor noted that he was having alcohol withdrawal problem.
True. He indicated that it was alcoholic hallucinosis, which my understanding is that that's a less severe form of alcohol withdrawal. As I indicated in the brief, although the doctor did note some hallucinations and there's some indication that the deputy that transported Mr. Mays to the hospital had indicated that he'd had a hallucination on the way there, there's no evidence that the suicide watch or log or any of the other incidents that were reported prior to transportation to the emergency room were conveyed to the doctor. So there's no evidence that the doctor actually had all the information necessary to make
The doctor examined him, right?
The doctor did examine him. And then
made his notes and ultimately released him.
Correct.
Gave him some treatment.
Gave him an injection of thiamine and said return in the following Monday, which was a day and a half later, for follow-up.
I thought it was Monday, on Sunday around midnight, that he was at the hospital. Isn't that right?
On the final, yes.
The first time. And then he said come back tomorrow, in effect.
Okay, I could be wrong on my...
Well, I thought it was a Sunday. In any event, could I just, as long as I've interrupted, you said that he had banged his head before he went to the hospital. My understanding is that he had hallucinations and that at some point he started smashing the wall or the bars or something, the door with his hand, but that the head banging happened after he had gone to see the doctor at the hospital.
That's correct, Your Honor. I did not mean to indicate that. I meant as a general continuum. It certainly was not until after he had returned from the hospital on the 16th of November that he started banging his head against the doors and walls.
All this transpired over a fairly, within 24 hours or less, didn't it?
That's correct. He returned shortly after midnight on the 16th of November from the hospital, and the head wound that resulted in his subdural hematoma occurred approximately 20 hours later. So during
as I understand it, they progressed from he progressed as he started inflicting pain on himself, aside from the hitting with his hand. They put him in that restraint chair, which I understand your expert thinks was inappropriate, and his the defendant's expert disputes that. But in any event, they did put him in the restraint chair for about an hour, and then they released him, and then they kept him, if I'm correct, on 15-minute watches, so that they were looking in on him, and then in some interval, apparently a 15-minute interval, he really whacked his head.
That's correct.
Is that what happened?
That's correct, although I would point out that...
So, if that's the case, counsel, you know, this is deliberate indifference, not a negligence case. So could you zero in on where the deliberate indifference was here?
Well, that wasn't the first. There were actually two prior incidents of him banging his head against the wall before he suffered the subdural hematoma. One,
that's where they put him in the restraint chair.
Actually, before the restraint chair, there is a reference that.
That's what I mean. That's why they put him in the restraint chair, because
there had been two prior occasions. That's correct. There, on one occasion, Deputy Gunter responded. There was blood all over the walls. He didn't put Mays in the restraint chair. Then, not too long afterwards, he did it again, and then they put him in the restraint chair. But the restraint chair, even the restraint chair, did not help with the symptoms of delirium tremens. He was continuing to harm himself even when he was in the restraint chair. He was picking in his chest and produce a wound there. He was able to re-wound his head. We don't know exactly how, if he banged his head against the wall, able to move the restraint chair or something like that. And notation was made that he was able to produce new bruises as well. And so with regard to the deliberate indifference, our position is that the head-banging and self-harm incidents that the deputies were clearly placed on notice that these were problems. He kept doing them. And every solution that they attempted to provide him and relief that they attempted to provide him, none of them worked. And they knew none of them worked. And so they release him from the restraint chair knowing that at any time he could do exactly what he had done on two previous occasions, which was bang his head against the door.
Why, in your view, if they've done A, X, Y, and Z, and none of it's effective, and then they release him from the chair, why is that equivalent to deliberate indifference as contrasted with negligence?
Because they had knowledge of facts that, in fact, two, both Martin and Gunter knew that Mr. Mays was suffering from delirium tremens. They knew that it was a serious health condition that could result in death. And after observing the very behaviors that ultimately, on at least two prior occasions, resulted in his subdural hematoma, none of the things that they did worked, and then they just released him to go back and do it again.
So what should they have done?
What they should have done, and I think I've cited several cases to the court that indicate that in those circumstances, specifically in the delirium tremens context, is what they should have done is notify medical personnel. The case law, as we've cited, indicates that they can't just simply rely on medical treatment or examination that occurred 20 hours before when the symptoms, by their own defendant's own admission, continued and actually even worsened. And he continued to suffer those. They personally observed them. At least two of the deputies actually knew about delirium tremens and that Mr. Mays was suffering from them, and they failed to contact medical personnel. That, in our view, is the very definition of deliberate indifference, particularly where Jacqueline Martin had testified that all of the deputies had received thorough training on delirium tremens and that medical personnel should be notified when the need arises. And so for that reason, we believe that there was deliberate indifference here. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Sonia Leonucci.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Sonia Leonucci for the appellees, the Nez Perce County deputy jailers in this case. As you've heard throughout the oral argument and read in the briefing, obviously we have a two-prong analysis here, whether or not there was a serious medical need and then whether or not the deputy jailers were deliberately indifferent to that need. I want to start with this issue of delirium tremens, first of all. You have heard in oral arguments today and seen in the briefing that Mr. Mays was one of the 5% of those individuals who developed delirium tremens when they're going through alcohol withdrawal. There is no credible evidence in this case anywhere in the record that Mr. Mays had delirium tremens, nowhere. What we see is, first of all, cases cited by the plaintiff that agree that delirium tremens and those symptoms will begin within 8 to 48 hours of the onset, and so of the last drink. And we know that Mr. Mays was incarcerated on November 7th, 2008. We don't start seeing anything until a week later. So he's completely off course for delirium tremens to begin with.
So your position that he was not suffering from a serious medical condition on that?
Our position is he was not suffering from delirium
tremens. No, that's not my question. My question is it your position that he was not suffering from a serious medical condition on that day?
On November 16th, 2008, our position is that he had received treatment for the medical condition that he was suffering from. And so at the time that this incident occurred,
he had fully been treated and taken care of and he had no problems.
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. He had problems, but the definition of whether or not it's a serious medical need.
You think there's at least a tribal issue of fact over that?
No, I don't. I don't think there's a tribal issue of fact.
When he comes back and he starts banging his head on the wall, it's your position that there's no tribal issue of fact as to whether or not he was suffering from a serious medical condition.
I don't think there's a
And even when you take into account the notes of the jailers.
Right. I think if you take into account the notes of the jailers, specifically Deputy Brown, who's the one who was responsible for getting him to the doctor in the first place, when you look at his notes on the second day, he says that his condition's actually improving at that point, that he's no longer shaking, he's no longer having the issues he was having before, which shows us that the condition he was experiencing wasn't the delirium tremens, which requires immediate hospitalization, but was actually alcohol withdrawals, which is often managed in the jail setting. A serious medical need means we got to get him to the hospital right now. That's the issue. But alcohol withdrawals, as we saw in this...
Well, he had a serious condition because they did take him to the hospital, didn't they?
They initially took him to the hospital, Your Honor, because...
Well, doctor told him he had to come to bring him back on Monday morning.
Right. They took him to the hospital because he had been banging his arm the night before, and he had injured it, and it was swollen. At that point, that was the reason they took him there. Fortunately for us, the patrol deputy who was responsible for taking him there had also been involved with Mr. Mays before, and so he explained to the doctor that this guy had had a hallucination on the way over, that his blood alcohol levels normally 0.2 or 0.3, that he's often a very violent individual. So the doctor's focus changed. It went from just looking at the arm to then looking at this hallucinosis issue. And fortunately for us, the doctor did a full workup. And what he said was he had no overt signs of withdrawal. He had an intentional tremor, which meant if he was sitting there and nobody was watching him, he wasn't shaking. But if somebody started watching him, then he would start shaking. That his gait was perfectly normal. That all of his vital signs were perfectly normal, and he wasn't toxic. All of those things are something you would see with delirium tremens. But if you're talking about just alcohol withdrawal, which is often managed in the jail setting, that's what we're dealing with. So there's no evidence that Mr. Mays had delirium tremens.
Let me just ask you this. Let's just assume for a moment, this is summary judgment, qualified immunity. We take any dispute in the facts in light most favorable to the non-moving party. In this case, it's the plaintiff.
That's correct.
And let's just assume for a moment that he's shown that there was a serious medical condition. So then he's got to get over. Then he's got to show that the officers were deliberately indifferent.
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't think that he can meet that burden. Absolutely not, so ever.
Well, the reason. Can he at least show that there's a tribal issue of fact?
I don't think there's a tribal issue of fact because we're not dealing with negligence. We're not dealing with gross negligence. We're dealing with deliberate indifference. And that is a very, very high standard. It requires showing that these deputy jailers had a culpable state of mind. It requires a showing here in a case that this circuit just heard on January 2nd, 2013, Pierce versus Long. The court in that case held that it's a. Must show that the defendant acted in a manner akin to criminal recklessness. We have deputy jailers who, once he comes back from the doctor, they are watching him like a hawk. His behavior is not significantly different. I understand that he was pushing his head against the wall, and they want to characterize it as bashing, but if you look at the record, what Mr. Mays was doing, the day before he had been banging his hand and he was hallucinating. The day after he comes back from the hospital, or after he returns, he's pushing his head against the wall. When Deputy Martin says to Kevin Mays, don't do that. Stop doing that. You're creating a cut on your head. He smiles at her and refuses to stop. So she puts him in the restraint chair. Whether or not you agree with that decision, there's nothing as far as case law that says that putting an individual incarcerated in a restraint chair is a constitutional violation. She puts him in the restraint chair. In this situation, he's released at 2:55. Nothing happens until 8:20 that night. From 3 o'clock to 8 o'clock at night, there is nothing going on. He is sitting in his cell. He's sitting on the bunk. He's standing up. He's not banging his head. He's not injuring himself. He's not doing anything. So how are the deputy jailers for 5 hours sitting there observing him?
Checking on him every 15 minutes?
Every 15 minutes, Your Honor. They started that on Saturday night. So they are going through this entire log, watching him every 15 minutes like a hawk. There is no information in the record that any of the deputies actually drew the inference that he needed to go to the emergency room.
Let me ask you one question about the state of the record. Is there anything in the record that would show express evidence of state of mind of the deputies, like any comment from a deputy about what they thought about this prisoner?
There is, Your Honor. In fact, there are several in the depositions that were provided in the record. Deputy Martin said that he was having the same behavior that he was having before. That's at 115.25, page 49. She also said that because he had gone to the doctor and they had sent him back, that she said, I believe if it was a serious situation, they would not have sent him back to the jail in our custody at that time. They all stated in their affidavits, which is submitted in the under seal record, supplemental excerpts of record, that they thought that he was improving, that he had not changed significantly, and that he had gone to that doctor that morning, and that none of them believed that he needed to return to the emergency room any sooner than he was already going to go there, which was the next morning for follow-up blood tests. So yes, that is in the record. Each of them, we went through each of them individually to lay out that information of what they were thinking at the time. Gabe Richardson, Deputy Richardson, he's the one who was the closest with him. He's the one who found him. And so he went through and explained he was the one giving him Kool-Aid and making sure that he was staying hydrated, and he thought he was coming out of it. Alcohol withdrawals are often managed in the jail setting. There's no question about that. And so,
do we have any Ninth Circuit precedent about when you can infer deliberate indifference from circumstantial evidence? Because I assume it's a pretty rare case where the government actor employee would say, I'm really indifferent to what this guy does or something.
I suppose that's true, Your Honor. There certainly are some cases out there that talk about the facts being so obvious that the court can then assume that because the facts are so obvious, the individual should have inferred that. But we don't have that case here. When you have an individual who's sitting there doing nothing for 5 hours, not harming himself, not injuring himself, not yelling out, not saying he's going to try to commit suicide, he's not doing anything. And when they pull him out of the restraint chair, he's calmed down, he's already been to the doctor. We don't have that situation here where the facts were so severe that the court is then just going to assume that the deputy should have known something different. And I think we also have the issue of delirium tremens versus this detox situation, which is often managed in the jail setting. And we have Deputy Martin saying, you know, I understood that DTs means delirium tremens, but you see that their deputies are using that interchangeable. I mean, and that's what happened in Spears versus County of Berrien too.
Does he have a negligence claim under Idaho law?
He does not. Because of the Idaho Tort Claims Act, he does not have a negligence claim.
Because he was in custody at the time?
Because he was in custody at the time. He would have had a negligence claim against the doctor if he thought he had misdiagnosed him, potentially. But
not against the...
Not against the deputies.
Not against the county.
Correct. Yeah, because he was in custody at the time. The Idaho Tort Claims Act precludes that. He also did not file any state claims in relation to that, just federal claims.
Right.
So...
Okay.
So, in final, I think obviously the issue here is the fact that the standard is deliberate indifference. I mean, it's such a very high standard. We're not dealing with negligence. We're not dealing with gross negligence. And there's nothing in the record that Mr. Mays can point to that would establish deliberate indifference on the behalf of any of these individual deputies. I mean, he's named everyone, including Deputy Brown, who actually arranged for him to receive medical treatment. They were all watching him like a hawk. They were making sure that nothing happened to him. And if anything would have happened, they would have made sure that he received medical treatment, which they did at 8:20 when he injured himself. So because of that, we're asking that you uphold the lower court's determination that dismissal was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Okay, Mr. Wood.
I have less than 30 seconds.
I'll tell you what, Stacy, could you put the time up to a minute so minute of rebuttal here.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the subjective state of mind, we have at least two of the deputies that admitted under oath that they knew Mr. Mays was suffering from DT's delirium tremens, that they understood DT's meant delirium tremens, and that it was a serious health condition, and that Mr. Mays was suffering from it even after he returned from the hospital. They didn't even rely. I mean, the counsel is relying upon the hospital's opinion. But the officers themselves were not relying on the hospital. They continued to believe, despite the treatment, after Mays returned from the hospital, that he suffered from delirium tremens. And Deputy...
That's the case, counsel, then you're cutting against deliberate indifference. It seems to me you're saying that they're willing to be concerned about DTs. You're just quarreling with the steps that they took to implement it.
Well, if someone has actual knowledge that someone is suffering from an admittedly serious life-threatening disease, and what they do is they simply continue to monitor, and that doesn't work. He continues, as Richardson testified, he continued throughout that day to be incoherent, hallucinating, yelling, talking to imaginary friends, all those things. He continued to do that throughout the day. And yet, they put him in a restraint chair. He beat his head against the wall once. They didn't do anything. They just said, we'll make note of it. They put him in a restraint chair. He continued to harm himself even when he was in a restraint chair after the second time he beat his head against the walls. That didn't help because he continued to hurt himself. And then, lo and behold, he did the exact same thing that they knew that he'd done before in the recent past. And this time it resulted in a subdural hematoma. They were on notice that what they were doing wasn't working, and that it was a serious life-threatening condition, and they didn't call medical personnel, which they were trained to do, and they failed to do it. And we believe that is the very definition of deliberate indifference.
Hey, Mr. Wood, I'm afraid your time is up. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
A little over, but thank you.
Thank you.
For your argument.
I feel better.
We thank both Ms. Nutch and Mr. Wood for their nice arguments, and the case of... Mays versus Stopey shall be submitted.